May. The report is. Yeah. Oh, sorry. The final date. Yeah. Oh, I can't remember.
Yeah.
It's very shortly after the end of semester, anyway. So that puts it back probably a little bit further. Yeah. I'm not supposed to give you material that's accessible that is due for handing in during your study period. So does that tell you any more? I'll have to figure out the date now, and I'll get back to you. Okay. All right. Now, we're going to have a look now at something else that will come into your designs. Now, remember I said in the last lecture, you know, most of what you need to know to do the project. And that's true. From the point of view of design, really, once you know about transistors and how to design circuits with transistors, you can go straight on to developing, to design that oscillator and get it to work. Okay, and that's 60% of your project. Okay, but there's more to RF design than just transistors. And one of the major topics that really comes out in RF, because receivers have to be sensitive in both telecommunications and even more so in radio astronomy, so you have to understand the physical limitations of small signals. If you're dealing with a signal that's minus 120 dBm, then you're competing with a lot of rubbish around the place in the airwaves in order to extract the signal that you desire. And apart from co-channel interference, one of the major thing is noise. Okay? So you've no doubt had come into contact with noise signals in the past somewhere. Is that right? Have you actually studied noise as a formal topic in any prior course? Anybody? Sorry?
Statistically, 226.
What's that? Statistics?
Yeah, or some Gaussian.
Oh, right, okay. So you've done the telecommunication information theory approach to noises and had to do white Gaussian noise. Okay. All right, so that's at least a picture now what noise is. Okay. There's a little bit more to the physics of noise, and it's a very exciting subject, and I'm by no means an expert at it, so you're going to have to work hard to understand my lectures, because I'm not an expert on noise at all. However, I first met noise in physics about 30 years ago, some long time ago. Noise is a fundamental aspect of electronic circuits. You can't get rid of it. It's always there. Okay. It has its origin in random motion of electrons, and you study that using statistical mechanics of thermodynamics in physics. Very often, at low energies, the electron velocity distributions are Maxwellian, which is a physicist's term for normal distribution, and so it's not surprising that the electromagnetic radiation produced by electrons is Gaussian. And that sort of noise is termed thermal noise or Johnson noise or white noise are the terms that physicists usually use to describe them, and as a matter of fact, electronics engineers. Okay. Sometimes thermal noise is modelled as being additive white and Gaussian, and I'll define what all that means in a minute, and it's led to this famous acronym AWGN. But there's also man-made noise, and it's usually much larger in amplitude than thermal noise, and I'll summarise a little bit about, show some examples of that as well. Now, the other thing that I find really a challenge is you have to distinguish between amplitude and phase noise. So anyone who's worked on the oscillators last week will understand why now, with a big smack in the face, what phase noise is. Okay? You had a VCO that oscillated, and it looked pretty clean, the spike. It was at 58 megahertz. It was way out of band. It wasn't where you wanted it to be. Okay? But it was nice looking. Then you put the phase lock loop on it. It now wandered back to the band where you wanted it to be, the phase lock loop is a servo loop to push the signal back into the band of the desired band. But the trouble was it no longer had a nice frequency. It was wandering all over the place, much wider than the free-running VCO. And there you met the curse of the phase lock loop. Phase lock loop that has bad response and is not properly shielded. When you're applying a voltage to a varactor diode to tune an oscillator, and you're hoping that the frequency is going to be accurate to 100 parts in a million, then you're hoping, the same hope is that the voltage on that capacitor so that is accurate to 100 parts in a million. And I guarantee you that that's a tiny, tiny, ridiculously tiny accuracy to ever hope a voltage to be. And noise, such as this, is one example of what comes into your circuit to prevent your voltages from ever being specifiable to 100 parts in a million. One part in 10,000, 0.01%, it's ridiculous to expect the amplitude of any voltage anywhere to stay that constant. Okay, so I have a fundamental problem. And that is a simple example of phase noise, or frequency noise, where the oscillator is no longer stable. It just jitters all over the place. The problem is that when noise enters a communication circuit in baseband and is upconverted to high frequency, the complex nature of the time-varying aspect of additive white Gaussian noise always has a phase noise component. So it's not conceptually possible to completely separate amplitude and phase noise. But loosely speaking, in this lecture, I'll stick my neck out and say I'm talking about amplitude noise, okay? And we'll talk about phase noise later on. All right, so here's additive white Gaussian noise. What does all that mean? Well, I sort of chickened out and got MATLAB to draw up some noise for you. The noise is additive white Gaussian. An additive white Gaussian noise is a special case of thermal noise. White means that the power is a constant function of frequency. In other words, it has a flat frequency spectrum, okay? The Gaussian means that the noise possesses a normally distributed amplitude. Now, if you go into MATLAB, you'll see the title on that is the MATLAB command you have to... you have y equals random, that's the MATLAB function for a normally distributed random variable, and we generate 1,000 numbers. And the random has a variance of 1, okay? And if you plot the variance determines the amplitude of this noisy signal, and you can see it's with a variance of 1, its amplitude's actually like between -2 and 2. And you can also use the MATLAB hist function to get a histogram of that, and that plots out what's called the probability distribution function, which is the distribution of amplitudes, which I've labelled y here, against the number of times for which they occur. And this is with 20 points out of each of these 1,000. So there are 20 bins, and each bin has 50 points, I should say. And you get a distribution that looks like a normal distribution. That's with 1,000, and as you increase the number, of course, it looks more and more like the bell curve. Oh, what happened there? Oh, sorry. Yeah, okay. Found a new key, hotkey. Right, probability density function. Just in case you don't know what that is, it's just the probability. It's a very strange way of specifying noise compared to physics and electronics to do in terms of probability distribution function. What you're asking is, what's the probability that the amplitude of the voltage you measure on this noise signal is in a certain range of amplitudes? Okay, that's what it means. And it's described by this function. So the probability that the amplitude lie between A and B is given by the integral dx of f of x. And a particular example of f of x, actually, is that one there, okay, the Gaussian distribution. And you can see that the probability of higher amplitudes gets larger as sigma becomes larger. Right, all right, back to the real world physics of noise now, or real world of noise. Random motion, some of this is rather surprising to you, I'm sure. Random motion of electrons and electromagnetic fields generates noise, and it does so at any temperature above absolute zero. Temperature is the only thing you need to produce noise. Okay? Right, so there's a famous formula that the noise power generated across the resistor's terminal, if the resistor is at temperature T, is given by that formula, where in SI units, the KB is Boltzmann's constant, is given by 1.38 by 10 to the minus 23 joules per degree Kelvin. So the temperature is the temperature in Kelvin, T is the temperature in Kelvin, and B is the bandwidth over which the power is measured. That is the bandwidth that you're limiting to this signal at the output of this resistor. You're only considering a subset of its possible bandwidth. And you know, depending on the resistor design, it can have quite a large bandwidth of resistor, right? It could go up to optical frequencies almost. Okay? And that gives you the power generated. In other words, you can measure that power by the root mean square voltage. You can put an oscilloscope across a resistor and see that, okay? Except for one tiny thing, it's usually small. For example, noise power generated in a circuit component at room temperature, okay? And notice I've set a circuit component now because the resistance value is not even mentioned in the formula. It doesn't care if it's a resistor, okay? Then it's 300 Kelvin. That's room temperature, by the way. Absolute zero, minus 273 degrees centigrade, is the lowest temperature of them all, okay? And the temperature in that has to be in Kelvin. I should have said that. So 300 Kelvin, 200 kilohertz bandwidth is 8 by 10 to the minus 16 watts, which is only minus 120 dBm. In other words, even thermal effects are going to destroy your receiver because your receiver needs to see signals down at that level of 200 kilohertz bandwidth. Tell you now, they do. Okay? So noise is a big issue, despite the fact that that is a small number. Okay? Everyone happy with that? Okay? Has anyone seen KTB before? No one's... Oh, you have. Okay, you've got three. Three physicists. Is that right? How did you see?
I
was going to say a word about that. Yeah, okay, good.
I started out work.
Good, excellent. So not at university yet. What about you, Lee?
I did thermal physics.
Ah, right, that's where I got it too. Physics. Thermodynamics, I guess. Is that right?
Yeah,
is that where you got it?
Second
year. Yeah, okay. The nature of noise. Okay, random motion of electrons generates noise electromagnetic fields. That's interesting because we've now gotten rid of all material. Electromagnetic waves propagate in a vacuum and they carry noise with them. Now, what bad news is that? Who's heard of the cosmic microwave background? Minus, was it 3 degrees Kelvin or something? Sorry, can't be minus 3 degrees Kelvin. 3 degrees Kelvin, sorry. 3 degrees Kelvin? Never heard of it. You've heard of it, yes. It's the background radiation from the Big Bang. It was measured in 1963 by Penzias and Wilson. Was it 63? Won the Nobel Prize for measuring it. That must have been, up until its time, that would have been the most significant astrophysical experiment ever done. Okay, up until its time. And they went to a lot of trouble. They've written a book about all the trouble they went to. All the trouble that they went to is described in the book in layman's terms by Stephen Weinberg called The First 3 Minutes, if you're interested in reading that. Must be commonly available still, The First 3 Minutes. When the Big Bang went off, out came all this electromagnetic radiation, and the universe started to expand and shifted the radiation, okay, in wavelength. And the radiation is at very low power, okay? And they measured that noise by a receiving antenna, a dish, simply. And of course it was a process of eliminating all the things that were interfering with it, from the ionosphere, man-made effects, pigeon feces. One day their results disappeared, their experimental results disappeared, and they had to investigate what caused the loss, and it was insertion loss in some pigeon excrement that pigeons had nested in their dish. Anyway. Well, it's all in Stephen Weinberg's book anyway. Such electromagnetic fields come from both natural and man-made sources. And now this is the punchline. Antennas pick up noise from the environment or outer space, like the cosmic background radiation from outer space, and introduce it into a circuit. Okay? Antennas therefore have a temperature that's completely unrelated to how warm they are. Because antennas interface to the environment, they have a resistance due to their ability to radiate and to collect electromagnetic radiation. And that resistance comes with a temperature that is the temperature of the sky. The electromagnetic waves in a vacuum give the vacuum a sky temperature. Okay? And so if you stick an antenna up to the heavens and you look at its output, you can see noise. That's what Penzias and Wilson did. But of course, it's much easier to see noise if you indiscriminately look for anything with an antenna. If you want to look for the cosmic background microwave radiation, that's a different matter. Okay. All right. So that's interesting. Noise is ubiquitous. But man-made noise, of course, just swamps everything, usually. And if you look at if you look with a gigantic satellite dish or a dish or some kind of dish antenna, we'll look at satellite link budgets and antennas in this course, then you'll see radiation picked up from the sky from various sources. And this is a bit of a premature graph for you. The FAM up there is actually a noise figure above KTV. And the T just depends simply on the ambient temperature with this antenna sitting in the sky. And so KTB would be the thermal limit, if you like. It's the smallest noise you've ever got, because when you have a specified temperature, you cannot see less noise than KTB. It's everywhere. It doesn't care what device has the temperature. If it has the temperature, it has the noise power. However, all sorts of effects, atmospheric effects, and everything from car engines, any electronic equipment is going to generate noise that adds to the sky temperature. Okay? And FAM is a noise figure, and we'll learn about noise figure in this lecture, but this is a slightly premature graph, we'll come back to it later by time, that's above the KTB of the atmosphere due to all manner of different sources. And so here we're looking at the right graph, I suppose, is the best one. You have it has the different sources over here, whereas over here it has their actual origin or where these were measured. So you can see a business area has more noise than does, say, a residential area, which in turn is larger than a rural area, which is much larger than a quiet rural area, which is here, or galactic noise, okay? And it differs between day and night as well. They're just, sample curves of what you would measure as ambient noise. And you can see they're quite a bit higher than thermal noise. 40 dB, these are in dB here. dB above KT0B.
Why is thermal noise at night?
Good question. Atmospheric noise, that is. That's purely atmospheric. That's a good question. Oh, let's think about that. When I saw it there, I thought, gee, I hope nobody asked that question. But you're right. Let's check it out. It's a borrowed view graph, by the way. I didn't sit up in my office taking this data. It's on the web somewhere. And I actually got that. I gave that to a student who put it in his report, and now I extracted it out of my report. His report, so there you go. All right, so not all noise even looks Gaussian. And here's the best example of this, due to car engines. This is binary data in green, corrupted by impulse noise, usually caused by high-voltage switching circuits, impulse noise. Look at what it does. It produces spikes that cause bit errors. Just occasionally a big bang, you get a big spike. So nothing like Gaussian at all, otherwise it would look like that MATLAB curve. All right. Now, performance measures. How do you use noise? What do we do if we're actually in a practical situation? In analog telecommunication systems, we measure noise by signal-to-noise ratio. That's what we do in RF, okay? You may all be aware, though, in digital telecommunications, in digital comms, noise is measured by a bit error rate. So that previous view graph is kind of a good example of it, really. You can see that these are the bits here. If you look very carefully at that green curve, you find their switching levels. It's actually an analog signal because this is 4 to 5 volts here. But their switching levels, they represent a digital signal. Every time a spike occurs, boom, the bit's killed, right? That's a bit error rate, the number of bits. And you're probably looking at one in 100 there. If assuming that the impulse noise is the only cause of bit errors. Low amplitude signals are most susceptible to corruption by noise, and they're common in radio systems. So Minus 160 dBm is possible in radio receivers, for example. How big is minus 160 dBm in watts? What's it in watts? Can anyone tell me it quickly? It's 10 to the minus 16, isn't it? But that's in with respect to milliwatts. So respecting watts, it's 10 to the... 10 to the minus 16,
yeah.
Right, milliwatts. So how many watts is that?
10 to the minus 19.
Yeah, it's 10 to the minus 19 watts. It sounds almost like an atomic specification, doesn't it? That's the sad part. It's almost atomic physics we're dealing with here. Much lower received powers are possible in radio astronomy, dictating the use of liquid nitrogen-cooled receivers. Why is that? I mean, Bridget, you might know. Why liquid nitrogen? What are they trying to do? Exactly, yeah. The problem with radio astronomy is you're actually interested in the noise. It's the noise you're looking at. And so the very first thing you need to do is to make sure that the thermal noise is much lower than the noise you're trying to measure. And the only way to get it down is by cooling the receiver. The thermal noise, by the way, is assumed to be not due to the sky temperature of the antenna there, but the receiver's own electronics. The receiver runs hot. And if it's hotter than the sky, then the receiver, and it has an amplifier in it, like an LNA, a light low noise amplifier, which I'll talk about in a minute, then obviously you want to cool it down to make sure that its noise does not exceed what you're trying to measure. Okay? All right. White noise power. This is a something that's pretty extracurricular to this course, but I think there's one thing I'd like to derive from this view graph. You know, the power spectral density of the noise is the power spectrum, which is the Fourier transform of the noise, and it's magnitude squared. The magnitude squared of the Fourier transform of the noise, in other words, the Fourier transform multiplied by its complex conjugate. That is Sn omega, that's the power spectral density of the noise, PSD. If you want to calculate the power in the noise over a certain bandwidth, so imagine now you have a carrier, right? There's a spike there at 39 megahertz and you have 100 kilohertz of bandwidth about it, then to find the noise power, the total noise power in that bandwidth, you have to integrate from F naught minus B over 2 to F naught plus B over 2, assuming that that bandwidth somehow means something, like you've got a filter in it, and it's symmetric around F naught, just for argument's sake. Then you end up with NB, where N is just the... Because it's white noise, Sn omega is actually independent of frequency, so they let it equal N. All right, if that's a power, then goodness, we must be able to calculate the RMS voltage, and so that's the purpose of this equation. And it leads to a startling result. It's probably not obvious. It's actually obvious if you've already used the spectrum analyzer by yourself and played around with it for a little while, but the bigger is your bandwidth, the bigger is the noise power. The noise actually increases in amplitude as you increase the bandwidth. That's the side effect of having a constant PSD, white noise. If the noise were monochromatic, it wouldn't increase in amplitude if you increase the bandwidth. Because you imagine putting a sine wave through a filter at a filter with a bandwidth of, say, 10 kilohertz, and the sine wave has a bandwidth of 1 hertz because it's really low phase noise, then if the filter doesn't attenuate it, then the output amplitude, you know, will be unchanged in going through that filter. But when you put white noise through a 10 kilohertz filter, the noise level drops. And so this is why, when making measurements last week, I often preferred to turn the resolution bandwidth on the spectrum analyzer down to 100 kilohertz instead of leaving it at megahertz before doing impedance measurements, because the noise generated inside the spectrum analyzer becomes an enemy of the measurement, which is unfortunate. It's actually rather high, though, and so it's good to get rid of it. All right. So I won't talk too much about definition of power spectral density, but that's an important formula when thinking. You can also see that if it's actually white noise, then this is KT, and we have KTBR is equal to the RMS voltage squared. So only then is there actually a voltage when there's a resistance, and that's because you need a resistance for power dissipation. All right. What's all this about? This is probably a repetition. Yeah. Yeah, but there is an issue here.
If you want the amplitude as measured in volts of your noise to mean anything, then you, or the power for that matter, you've got to have a well-defined bandwidth in your system somehow. You've got to actually enforce it. If you don't have a bandwidth restriction, then noise will swamp your signals before you can do anything. And so bandwidth is a crucial component of any noise calculation. And I said that already. That's fine. The definition of signal-to-noise ratio is the power of your signal divided by N0B, where N0 is the power spectral density. Or would that be KT be if it's thermal, truly thermal noise in the unlikely situation? All right, now we get finally up to this noise performance in power amplifiers. The first thing, this is very simple now. We're going to turn the numbers. If you have an active device, like an amplifier, a low noise amplifier, you can look up in its GoRes data sheet and you can look up a property called the noise figure. The noise figure is how is a positive number in dB. Usually noise factor is the ratio, and noise factor is the ratio. Okay, we'll do the noise figure in a minute. Then it's simply the ratio of the input signal to noise over the output signal to noise of the amplifier. It's a property of the amplifier. And it's independent of bandwidth because bandwidth divides in the ratio of those two equations. Noise figure, that's all it is. So what does it say? Well, noise figure is always greater than one, so it means that basically as far as noise goes, amplifiers are worsenators. The signal to noise ratio, remember it's signal to noise, so the bigger the better, right? When you go through an amplifier, things get worse. The output signal to noise ratio is always lower than the input signal to noise ratio in any amplifier. And a low noise amplifier is an amplifier that does your job in terms of amplification, plus it has a very low noise figure. Noise figures have to be less than about 10 dB. Noise figures, that is. I'll get onto that. Or a factor of 10. That noise factor has to be less than 10 for you to dare to call the amplifier a low noise amplifier. 1 dB is more typical, okay? Okay, so SNRI is always greater than that. The noise is only amplified when the noise factor is only amplified when the noise factor is zero, noise figure is zero, and amplifiers make things worse. So noise figure is simply, I think I've got something wrong there, NF, that is NF. NF is the symbol for noise figure, and when F is 1, NF is 0. That's what that crazy sentence was supposed to say. Okay? All right. You never, if noise figure were the only thing for one amplifier you ever needed, then of course you could just... you're almost meaningless to put it in a data sheet. What's important for you when you're designing receivers is to combine noise figures so that you can work out how bad your receiver chain gets. Now, this is interesting because your tendency till now from your electronics courses would be, well, if I can have an amplifier with a gain of 10, I can cascade 3 of them to make a gain of 1,000. And that's true. The problem is that you don't. If the reason for having a gain of 1,000 was you wanted to look at 1 millivolt and turn that into 1 volt, then noise figure, a cumulative noise figure of those 3 amplifiers may prevent you from even considering trying to amplify it. You may want to live with a lower amplitude signal of the output. Because the more you put in, the worse things get. And this is the formula, and it's a very interesting formula. These are noise factors now. We're doing this in terms of ratios. So don't use dBs in ratios, okay? The total noise factor is given by the sum of these noise factors. So F1 is your first amplifier, or passive component, actually. And this then is the second, and this is the third. And you'll notice that the further you go down, you divide by the gain of the first stage. So F2 minus F1 is divided by the gain of F1, okay? So the first rule about combining amplifiers here is almost contradicts what I just said, and says if you're going to have a low noise amplifier anyway, you better make it the first one. It's better to make it the first one because the overall noise figure is dominated by the F1 term. If the gain of F, if that first amplifier is large enough. So suppose the gain is 10, then this formula depends on F1 directly, but only on 1/10. Of F2 minus 1 anyway. And F2 is low, then that term might already be insignificant. So that's the formula for combining a cascade of amplifiers, where the FK are the noise factors, in order to obtain the total noise factor. And then there's this conclusion. The first amplifier is the one. So make sure that when you build a receiver, you have the low noise amplifier up front. Okay? All right. Now, got about 5 minutes. Before we go on and define the noise factor of a passive network, we have to get clear in our minds, and I haven't done it before in this course, so I may as well put it up on the board. What's the difference between all of those terms? Transfer function, which you know from electronics or signals courses, insertion loss, which is the same as conversion loss, and attenuation. Okay, now I've explained this to some students before, but only in the context of solve, and so we'll do it in this context. The transfer function of a four-port network is the ratio of its output voltage V0 when terminated in Z0, that is, the network itself is terminated, to that when the network is replaced by Z0. So basically that means the following. So here's your four-port network. You terminate that in Z0. That in Z0. The other thing you do is this. So this is V out, and that's what Vn is. Now, in my equation for transfer function using solve, you realise that I'd in fact done that. What I said was, this is equivalent, in fact, to the ratio of the forward voltage here to the forward voltage here. And this is how you figure out the forward voltage at this point. Okay, so that's easy. Transfer function you've seen before. And another thing that's interesting about it is because it only works on forward voltages, it completely ignores return loss. And so the only way the transfer function could be less than 1 is if the return loss, if there's dissipation within the network. And as a consequence of that, insertion loss or conversion loss is the same as the transfer function. Attenuation, on the other hand, is indiscriminate. It includes both return loss and the loss due to the to insertion loss, and so that is reflections are included. And so, if in solve you would use this, the transfer function is defined by that in solve, because if you draw the Thevenin equivalent circuit down for this guy, you would do this. You see, you've got 1 amp there, and you've got Z0 and Z0 are now in parallel. And so the input voltage, VI, is actually given by 1 over 2 Z0, and so that's why Z0 over 2, and so that's why this is factor here, 2 V0 on Z0. The attenuation, on the other hand, is V0 on VI, where VI is actually the input voltage under these conditions, so it's this guy instead. So attenuation is V0 on VI, and if you now calculate VI, you can show that the transfer function is just the attenuation by 1 plus rho, where rho is the reflection coefficient. All right, so with that clearly in our minds, and how far do I have to go? Oh, I've got an example. I might do the example in the next lecture, actually, but let's just define the noise performance of a passive network. Well, it's easy. The noise factor of a passive network is equal to its transfer function. It's the insertion loss. So that's interesting. Why is it that if you put a signal into a passive network, that when the signal comes out of the passive network, it comes out with a lower signal-to-noise ratio than when it went in? Can anyone explain that to me? Because after all, shouldn't the noise be attenuated too? This is your last book for the day, I think.
Noise has been introduced as well.
Yeah, if you have a passive network, like a filter, right? A filter's a passive network. If you put a signal into it, and you've got Z0 here, and this is a filter, has a certain transfer function. Signal-to-noise ratio here, let's say it's SNRI, and here's SNRO. What we're saying is that SNRI on SNRO
is equal to TF. It's equal to the transfer function.
Why does it get worse? Can anyone see why it gets worse? You have to think about the nature of noise to understand this one. It gets worse by the insertion loss of the filter. And mixers, passive mixers, for example, always have conversion. They call it conversion loss, but it's a kind of insertion loss. Okay? It's exactly the same thing. And when you calculate the noise figure of a mixer, with a passive mixer, it's a conversion loss. If it's the 1496, which is an active mixer, you need to look it up. It'll be specified in the data sheet. Although I checked this morning, it's not, so we're going to find it, right? We're going to find it. But it should be insignificant by our first formula. It should be after the LNA. So the LNA's noise figure is the dominant one for our receiver design. But now suppose we've got a filter, the preselector. The preselector might have a 3 dB attenuation in the passband. That means that it's already giving you a noise figure that's a 3 dB. And that will add to the rest of the noise figure. It's not directly, but by that formula above. And it'll go before the LNA. So the noise figure contribution of your filter is important, unless your filter has zero attenuation and has no losses.
Okay. All right, so here's the answer. The signal going into your filter is attenuated by 3 dB, let's say. It's an imperfect filter. What about the noise? Is it attenuated?
When noise goes into a filter, does it ever get attenuated? And the answer is yes, provided there's a temperature gradient across your filter so that the temperature at the input of the filter is higher than that at the output. Because then you will attenuate the noise, otherwise you won't. Why? Because the filter's terminated in 50 ohms, and if the temperature at the output of the filter at the input of the filter is the same, then the noise power on that 50 ohm impedance is exactly the same at the input as the output. In fact, the noise at the in each case, no, doesn't even know about each other. The noise is exactly the same. So filters make noise figure worse. They cause an attenuation of your signal, but not an attenuation of noise. Okay? And because we're dealing about noise power, it doesn't even care if it's a matching network that goes from one impedance level to another. It doesn't increase the noise figure at all. It doesn't change it, though you can't fiddle it that way either. It always makes things worse. All right, at the start of the next lecture, I'll give you an example of how to do this. These are very difficult concepts, right? Very difficult concept. But you have to, once you see an example, you say, God, it's so easy. And it is easy. It's a purely technical matter to substitute into the equations and do a receiver design. The formulae themselves are what is complex. This is complicated. The one for the amplifier is so complicated you probably dare not ask the question about how an amplifier worsens noise performance, but it's intuitively obvious that if a filter worsens it, then an amplifier is just going to be, it's just got active components all over the place and will more than likely worsen it. Okay? Any questions? All right, so in the next lecture we continue the saga of noise.